In November of 1992, three girls went missing from a small town near the eastern Spanish coast, a small town named Alcácer. The names of the three girls were Tony Gomez Rodriguez, Desiree Hernandez Fulch, and Miriam Garcia Ibora. The three girls, who left a friend's house at around 7 o'clock in the evening, were headed to a nightclub in a neighboring town. Unfortunately, they never made it to their destination. One eyewitness reported to police that she had seen three girls matching their description get into a white sedan with a handful of older-looking men. This sighting would cement what the police were already thinking, that the girls had met foul play. Over the next 75 days, the Spanish media was alight with the story. Talk show hosts made trips to Alcácer to interview the family and friends of the three girls, along with politicians. This included the Interior Minister, who organized a task force specifically to find the girls, abbreviated as the UCO. And the President of Spain at the time, Felipe González, even met with the family to express his personal concerns. But on a fateful day at the end of January, 2.5 months later, the bodies of the three girls were found. They were discovered by some middle-aged beekeepers who were exploring a large chunk of property that they owned in La Romana, roughly half an hour south of where the girls had gone missing from. The investigators identified the girls at the scene, identifying articles of clothing that they were wearing. However, in the process of exhuming the bodies, the forensic teams involved cut some corners. Only one photo was taken of the scene before all three bodies were exhumed, and police did not take any notes about where they found specific pieces of evidence. This would come into play later on, when they used random bits of evidence to charge a prime suspect. Using a discarded hospital pamphlet found nearby where the bodies had been buried, the police quickly found their way to a group of suspects. The pamphlet had belonged to a young man named Enrique Angles, whose older brother, Antonio, was an escaped convict who had a history of violence. And living with Enrique, at the time of his arrest, was another troubled young man named Miguel Ricart, whose only known crimes at this point in time were stealing cars to support a growing drug habit. Within 24 hours of the discovery of the three bodies, police had officially named Miguel an accomplice to the murder, and they even worked a confession out of him. But, as you may have guessed, the story was far from over. In fact, it would just get crazier in the coming weeks, months, and years. Welcome to the Unresolved Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Whelan, and this episode is part 3 of a series titled The Alcácer Girls. While some of you may have anticipated this being the finale of the story, I have decided to lengthen the series just a tad. This will actually be the first story I'm splitting up into more than 3 parts, just because all the information that's out there simply won't work as a single concluding episode. So I'm going to be releasing a part 4 of the series very soon, and perhaps even a part 5, depending on how things go for the next chapter. Before I get started, I'd like to quickly tell you about how you can support the podcast. If you could you please head to Apple Podcasts or whatever app you're using, and simply leave the podcast a good review? This is something that would require just a few moments of your time, and it would really help out a ton. If you would like to support the podcast even more than that, perhaps earning access to some bonus content like commercial-free episodes, and even a monthly poll to decide the subject of upcoming episodes, head to patreon.com/unresolvedpod. I also have links to the Patreon page on the podcast website, which is unresolved.me. But now that I've gotten that out of the way, I'll dive right back into the story. The tragic murder of the three victims, Tony Gomez Rodriguez, Desiree Hernandez Fulch, and Miriam Garcia Ibora, was just the beginning of what would go on to engulf the Spanish media for a matter of years. When I last left you at the end of part 2, one of the suspects, Miguel Ricart, had confessed to police. This confession had come after the first autopsy, when police began to get a better idea of how the three victims had met their fate. But the autopsy would not tell the whole story, and it left plenty of holes that would have to be explored by both investigators or Miguel's defense team. Namely, the idea that this confession had been coerced through torture, a claim that Miguel would bring about just a short time after this. But at the moment, police had a chief suspect that they were gunning for. Miguel's friend and drug supplier named Antonio Angles. Antonio Inglis was a drug dealer with a history of violent and non-violent crime. He had been arrested 5 times, mostly for drug offenses, but his last arrest had come from chaining a woman to a pillar and beating her for the better part of an entire day. The reason for this violent outburst? Because she had stolen a bag of heroin that he was planning to sell. Antonio was convicted for this offense, but he made an escape from his sentence while on a 6-day pass. He was allowed to go home for about a week, and he just decided to never go back. That was in March of 1992, and a warrant for his arrest was not signed until September, over 6 months later. 2 months after this, the 3 Alcacer girls went missing, and the rest is pretty much history. Police began to view Antonio as the chief suspect behind the crime. Miguel's confession, which would later change in its follow-up incarnations, implicated Antonio in the murder of all 3 girls. But the police had no idea where to find this man. His trail became incredibly complicated when police discovered that they had almost detained him on the day they went to the Inglis home, which was January 27th. On the same day that police were led to the bodies of the 3 teenage victims, they discovered pieces of paper. These were bits of paper from an outpatient pamphlet from a hospital in Valencia. The name on this document was Enrique Inglis, Antonio's brother. Enrique lived at a home in Cotarroya with several family members, including their mother, a sister, and a handful of the Inglis brothers. Miguel Ricart also happened to live here, on a temporary going on permanent basis. This is where they detained Miguel, obtained a confession, etc. The stuff I told you about in part 2. However, things would reach an interesting point when police began to speculate, based off of rumors about the Inglis family, that Antonio had been in the family home when they went there to arrest his brother Enrique and Miguel Ricart. They did detain the entirety of the Inglis family that was present, but through unconfirmed sources, it has been bandied about that Antonio was actually at the home when police arrived. The media, enticed by the police themselves, began to speculate that Antonio, who they presume was staying in a bedroom on the 4th floor of the building, had jumped out of a window when the Civil Guard arrived to question his family. And believe it or not, that is not where his story ends. Not even close. As if jumping out of a 20-plus foot window was not enough, the likes of which would have likely resulted in a serious injury, rumors nipped at the heels of Antonio Inglis for the next 20 years. As I've already stated, Antonio had been released from prison on a temporary basis back in March of 1992. In September, the warrant was issued for his arrest. In November, the Alcacer girls disappeared. Here we were now in January, almost a year after he left prison, and there had been no official sighting of Antonio since. Gossip began to be thrown around that Antonio had been living with the rest of his Inglis family members, but the police never bothered to check there to see if he was active. For all we know, they performed these checks and they found nothing. But there are no records of police actually following up on the September arrest warrant. There's simply nothing. But now that Miguel Ricart, one of Antonio's friends, had been arrested and confessed to the crime while implicating Antonio as the ringleader, police had to come up with a story to fit why they had committed this crime. I stated in the last episode that several of Antonio's friends and family members said that he was gay. Despite the rape and murder of the 3 girls looking like a brutal, opportunistic crime, police began to view it as a crime of hate. They stated that, due to Antonio's violent nature, his abusive relationship with his mother, and the kidnapping and beating of his former acquaintance, the one that he chained to a pillar at his family's home and beat, that he despised women. This was the prosecutor's alleged motive for the crime. Not that Antonio wanted to kidnap and rape these 3 teenage girls for pleasure, but rather that he hated women. And Miguel had apparently gone along with it because he was afraid of Antonio and didn't want to simply rock the boat. So now, the story became framed around that narrative. And Antonio, who had last been seen about a year beforehand, was now rumored to be on the run after jumping out of a 4th-story window. Mind you, there was a pretty big police presence around the Inglis home when the family was taken in for questioning. If anyone would have jumped out of a 4th-story window, they would have been seen by someone. After that, he would be spotted throughout the area by eyewitnesses, sightings that began to put together a narrative, that of Antonio Anglas, wanted fugitive, outrunning police for over a month. Roughly a week after the arrest and confession of Miguel Ricart, police stated that they had lost the trail of Antonio Anglas. However, that would not stop rumors of Antonio, who has still, to this day, never been found. While the search for Antonio Anglas continued, and began to expand to neighboring countries, putting Antonio on the radar of Interpol, detectives began to further squeeze Miguel Ricart for more information. As I told you in the last episode, Miguel confessed, but his confession was missing a few stark details, namely, where the girls had died, how they had died, and how the entire series of events had transpired. Most of these details would come to life after the first autopsy, which missed a lot of information. And Miguel would later claim to have been beaten into confessing based on what the police knew at the time of the confession. Of course, Miguel's confessions would change when a second autopsy was performed, illuminating detectives to add more information about the case to their case files. Police knew that the girls had been raped and murdered, and likely tortured throughout the terrible process. But during their first autopsy, the team responsible for examining the bodies had done something unthinkable. They had cleansed the bodies with water during the autopsy. Much of the forensic evidence that could have been recovered from their bodies was now gone forever. Literally gone down the drain. I wish I could tell you that this did not happen, and that this is just a poorly translated article I stumbled upon, but the first autopsy has been ridiculed in the decades since for being very poorly performed. The person behind the second autopsy, Dr. Luis Frontella Carreras, a professor at the nearby University of Seville, wrote a scathing indictment of the first autopsy in his own reports. He critiqued that autopsy for permanently damaging much of the evidence, such as collecting hairs found on the bodies in a single container, where they became intertwined and basically one big blob of hair, performing unnecessary amputations of the bodies, and discarding evidence that could have been useful for forensics later on, such as the larva found on the corpses. A direct quote from Dr. Frontella's report stated that the poorly performed first autopsy could lead to significant discrepancies in verifying the statements of the accused with the facts and the reconstruction of the event, and would prevent the exact truth of what happened from being discovered. This second autopsy was performed on January 29th, just a day after the first one. It lasted until roughly 9:30 in the evening, and of course, Miguel Ricart would make another confession just a couple of hours later, apparently clarifying what he had meant the night before. During this second confession, Miguel offered up a lot of information that better helped investigators fill in what had happened between the girls' abduction in Picassent and their eventual burial in La Romana. In this confession, he talked about how he and Antonio had picked up the girls in Picassent at around 8 o'clock that evening, and then drove them out to La Romana under a more threatening guise. Antonio had apparently hit one of them in the mouth with the butt of his gun, breaking her teeth. This completely goes against the story he told the night before, when he alleged that their journey out to the mountains was peaceful, but it does fit in with what police had learned from the autopsies. One of the girls had several broken and missing teeth, so this began to explain that. Miguel's second confession also states that they traveled out to an undetermined location to rape and torture the girls. Remember, the girls had been buried at La Romana, but they had been killed somewhere else. Police still had no idea where, so Miguel's confession remarkably lacks that information. And apparently police didn't press him very hard on that, despite that location being of great importance to the entire investigation. In this confession, a lot of the minor details from the first confession changed. Miguel and Antonio no longer drove a blue vehicle that belonged to Antonio, but drove the white Opel Corsa that Miguel was known for. Instead of miraculously finding a pit to bury the girls in, they brought a hoe and rake with them to dig it. Things like that, when you truly think about them, go completely at odds with what Miguel had just said 24 hours beforehand. This would continue to happen throughout Miguel's various confessions. He would constantly change details to fit what it was police thought had happened, and a lot of that depended on the autopsies themselves. At this point, in the first half of 1993, DNA testing was not used as commonly as it is now. Just for a reference point, the O.J. Simpson trial would not begin for almost 2 years, and at that point, DNA testing was still struggling to work its way into criminal proceedings. It had been used sporadically to nab offenders, but it wasn't seen as the most effective method to identify and convict criminals, yet. So it makes sense that police would at least try to utilize some methods of testing to go after Miguel Ricart and Antonio Inglés in the upcoming trial. I mean, if there was any evidence found of the two men at the crime scene, then it should have made their case a slam dunk. At this point in February of 1993, that was all they needed. While performing the second autopsy, the forensics teams identified 15 individual hairs on the bodies of the three girls. Almost all of these had the consistency of pubic hairs, and they were found on or around the bodies of the three victims. Police would have to wait for testing to commence, as the next few years would see forensic testing take a big leap forward. Needless to say, these 15 hairs would come into play later on. I should also tell you that eventually, the videos of these first two autopsies would either go missing or be deleted. That would be another major blunder that the investigative team had to face. But one has to wonder how a team like that can make so many mistakes, yet still manage to apprehend their main suspect just hours after discovering the bodies. While Miguel Ricart continued his confessions and toiled away in a prison cell, the chief suspect the police were after, Antonio Inglés, was spotted multiple times over the next month or so. Of course, police failed to detain him, but he left behind a trail of breadcrumbs that solidified to the civil guard that he was the meticulous, depraved madman that they believed him to be. Police allegedly received reports in the days after Miguel and members of his own family were detained by police that Antonio was spotted in the Cataroya area by multiple people. First, by a taxi driver who drove Antonio from his hometown of Cataroya to the nearby town of Turris. And secondly, by a hairdresser who reported that Antonio was dyeing his hair. He had apparently been spotted with bleached blonde hair and was returning his hair to a darker, less noticeable color. That evening, Antonio tried to get a room at a hostel named Baluda, but was turned away because the hotel clerk identified him as Antonio Inglés. At this point, he was one of the most wanted men in all of Spain, so it made sense that he wouldn't be able to get away flawlessly. However, by the time police arrived at the hostel, Antonio was gone into the wind. This would become a theme over the next month or so. Police claiming to be hot on his tail, and always on the cusp of finding him because of how much evidence he had left behind. But every single time they reportedly got close, Antonio, who was simply a delinquent drug dealer, was one step ahead of them. After getting turned away from the hostel in the northern part of Turris, Antonio apparently turned to a location that he had often shared with his brothers and Miguel Ricart. Reporters have called this place a hideout, but I like to think of it as the Inglés brothers' version of Snoopy's Playhouse. Police would later theorize that this is where the three Alcácer girls had been tortured, raped, and murdered, despite there being no physical evidence that ever tied them to the location. This was a large shed located nearby a home owned by someone referred to as the Gypsy. Apparently, the Gypsy was a delinquent just like Antonio and Miguel, but was renowned for his ability to pawn things. Antonio allegedly turned to this hideout on January 30th. This is the day after the second autopsy was performed, and just hours after Miguel gave his second midnight confession to investigators. It was roughly 2 o'clock in the morning when Antonio apparently arrived at the shed, and news reports differ on his mood. Some call him irrationally angry, waving a gun around like a lunatic. But others refer to the gypsy as a longtime friend of Antonio's from whom he had simply asked a favor of. Either way, Antonio was apparently in the market for a vehicle to make his escape. However, Antonio did not realize that this man, known as the Gypsy, would rat him out to police. Apparently, Antonio had gone and slept somewhere else, and when he returned later in the day, police were there. Antonio would make his escape yet again. In early February, Antonio allegedly stayed at another hostel. When police showed up on February 4th, the bed in which Antonio had reportedly been sleeping in was photographed. Almost comically staged, the bed was covered in pornographic magazines. They weren't even subtle about it. Police spokesman would later tell the Spanish newspaper Levante EMV on February 5th that security forces have lost track of the whereabouts of Antonio Anglas. Despite the police seeming to have no idea where this criminal mastermind was, Antonio Anglas continued to make his presence known. On February 6th, just a day after police claimed to have no idea where he was spotted by a truck driver at Zitiva Station, located in Valencia. At this point, he had apparently changed his image dramatically. Instead of being incredibly prim and neat, he was rocking a scratched-up face with a week's worth of stubble. Antonio had apparently become aggressive, as one would expect from an alleged criminal of his stature. He threatened this truck driver with a small axe he wore on his belt, and then he just simply went on his way. From here, he was rumored to start traveling as a stowaway inside the cargo containers of semi-trucks. On Wednesday, February 10th, 1993, Antonio was spotted by yet another truck driver who discovered him. This driver ran inside to a nearby warehouse to call the authorities, but by the time they arrived, you guessed it, Antonio was long gone. On February 16th, 1993, the magazine El País published a story about the civil guard searching the area of Graja de Iniesta. This region was a smaller, sparsely populated municipality in the region of Cuenca. The police had been notified about Antonio Anglas' appearance in the area, which was roughly 200 kilometers west of Valencia. The story went like this. Apparently, days beforehand, Antonio had apprehended a man named Vicente Golf. Vicente was a 65-year-old farmer that lived in the Valencia area, and Antonio threatened the man's life. He told him that he wanted transportation to the town of Minglanilla. Vicente, obviously, did as Antonio demanded. He drove him the 200 or so kilometers west, and was let go by the fugitive. However, he did not report the incident to police for almost 2 days, after worrying about reprisal from the escaped madman. By the time the civil guard received word of this, all trace of Antonio Anglas had been lost yet again. But they would continue looking for him, while Antonio would continue to leave a track of his whereabouts. During their drive to central Spain, Antonio told his prisoner Vicente that he was an innocent man accused of 3 murders. He didn't go into much detail, but he did make his intentions clear. He was planning to leave Spain behind entirely. Police began to plan for this accordingly. They had picked up on comments Antonio had allegedly made to the taxi driver who saw him on January 27th that he was heading to Madrid. They figured that, from there, he might try and figure out passage out of Spain, perhaps even back to Brazil, where he had been born and had dual citizenship. He reportedly stole a vehicle, but only used it to travel a few miles. Reports say that he was approaching a police traffic stop, and he left the vehicle behind there. From there, he disappears for a couple of weeks, until his presence is noted again. However, this time, it's back in Valencia, hundreds of miles east. The owner of a home, named Julio Planchot Ochando, had returned to his villa in the latter half of February, and discovered objects that did not belong to himself. There was a wallet sitting on the nightstand of a bed, which had photographs and ID cards belonging to Antonio Anglas. The photos apparently showed him with and without his bleached blonde hair, giving police the perfect photos to present to the media to try and track him down. Found at this location were also belongings of Antonio's. Clothing, money, equipment, etc. It was as if he had left everything behind, but for what reason, we can only guess. Many online theorists have theorized in the years since that this was just another staged part of the police trying to frame Antonio Anglès for the murders. The photos found at this villa, allegedly taken by Antonio himself, looked staged. In fact, rumors have tailed one of the photos, which was presented to the press as the most recent photo of Antonio. It's him with bleached, light-colored hair, and rumors have tied it to being a photo of a male model from South America. The rumors claim that the man in the photo isn't even Antonio, and that the police speculation of his hair being bleached again began with evidence found at the crime scene itself. If you remember, I told you about all manner of garbage being discovered at the crime scene. Well, one of the pieces of garbage was the packaging from a blonde hair dye product. If I'm being honest, I can't really toss away these rumors. The only word we ever have that Antonio bleached his hair is from an eyewitness that claimed he dyed his hair at a hair salon, and this photo, which is itself controversial. That's it. Like I said in the last episode, Antonio had not officially been seen by anyone since March of 1992, about a year before this alleged escape from Valencia. I take all of these sightings with a huge grain of salt because of that. After walking out of prison in March of 1992, Antonio Anglès basically became a phantom. Almost a month would pass, and the police were still looking for any sign of Antonio Anglès. At this point, after all of his alleged near misses with police and Spanish law enforcement, he was starting to become a bit of a myth. Rumors began to reach prying ears that Antonio had been spotted in Portugal, having made it into international territory. Central Brigade homicide detectives began searching in the area of the Portuguese capital, Lisbon, on March 24, 1993. The rumors came from a Portuguese drug addict, who went by the name of Joaquim Carvalho. He had apparently hosted Antonio Anglès for over 2 weeks, which would have put Antonio in Portugal at the beginning of March. Joaquim had been a longtime acquaintance of Antonio, and the two had even called themselves friends. However, this friendship reached a natural conclusion when Antonio stole Joaquim's passport and was planning to make good on his intention to find a ship that was sailing to his nation of birth, Brazil. A few days later, on March 27th, 2 months to the day after the bodies of the three Alcácer girls had been found, Portuguese officials announced that they were calling off the search, which had provided no new evidence whatsoever. Surprisingly though, that was not the end of the story. It was later announced that certain officials believed that Antonio Anglès had managed to avoid capture yet again. I would like to remind everyone once more that Antonio Anglès was not a special agent of any kind. Before the murder of the three girls, he had been seen as a low-life drug dealer. In fact, police felt so strongly about him not being a threat to society that they let him go on a week-long pass back home. Now, however, he had managed to trek nearly 1,000 kilometers, mostly on foot, and had crossed international borders and was now trying to search for a way off of the European continent. And throughout this journey, he was one of Western Europe's most wanted criminals, with multiple versions of his own face plastered all over the media. Despite this, police began to believe that Antonio had stowed away aboard a cargo ship headed for Dublin, named the City of Plymouth. Over the next week or two, police believe, Antonio pretended to be a Portuguese stowaway who lived in the engine room of the City of Plymouth. The crew had discovered him as they approached Ireland, and that was when Antonio apparently found himself in the cold water. Some reports claim that Antonio jumped from the ship into the ocean himself, while others claim that the crew of the ship threw him into the sea with a life jacket. Others also theorize that perhaps Antonio paid off some of the crew members with some of the money he had run away with. Since none of these have ever been verified, I'll let you decide what makes for a better story. But either way, Antonio found himself in the water off of the coast of Ireland, where he would last be seen by any eyewitness record. The crew of the City of Plymouth claimed to have had no knowledge of his presence aboard the ship, only discovering him days after they set sail. They had had no idea he was aboard, and the crew went on the record stating that they didn't help him escape and did not know of his existence. In fact, they did a stowaway check before departing Lisbon and found no trace of him then. Yet, somehow and some way, Antonio Anglès continued to avoid police oversight. When the City of Plymouth pulled into the Dublin harbor, police were there to try and detain Antonio Anglès. Through his own actions or those of the crew, Antonio was again nowhere to be found. The Spanish Civil Guard have clung to this story in the years since, that Antonio Inglis was last seen in the waters off of the Irish coast. He has not been seen by anyone since. Interpol officials apparently verified his presence on the ship by finding some of Antonio's fingerprints on the city of Plymouth, which matched what they had on file. However, this has become heavily scrutinized in the years since, when journalists discovered that the quote-unquote fingerprint match came from a partial palm print, thus leading to doubts as to whether or not Antonio had ever been on board, and whether he was even the Portuguese stowaway, or it was just someone who looked like him. 2 years later, in September of 1995, a skull was discovered off the coast of County Cork, Ireland. This skull had the unusual trait of a deviated septum, which was a feature of Antonio Inglis. Police would test the DNA from this skull to the DNA of Antonio's mother, Naisa Martins, but the test came back negative. Police believe that even though this skull did not match that of Antonio Inglis, that he might have perished off the coast of Ireland. In March of 1996, police were tipped off by a prostitute that a man with a similar tattoo as Antonio was spotted in Uruguay. By the time police arrived to check out the suspect, he was long gone. Whether or not you believe that Antonio Inglis might be guilty, you cannot deny that his story is a completely unresolved tale. He escaped justice, at the very least, by skipping out of his remaining prison sentence, and he has remained one of Interpol's most wanted fugitives ever since. Rumors have continued to nip at the heels of the Inglis family for decades, with theories cropping up that Antonio has been spotted in Brazil and even Miami, Florida. Unfortunately, we have little to no proof that Antonio has even been alive throughout this entire ordeal. Many online theorists have speculated that Antonio was either long gone or dead before the three Alcacer girls went missing, and police have fabricated the entire story of his escape. He has never had his day in court for the murder of Tony Gomez Rodriguez, Desiree Hernandez Fulch, and Miriam Garcia Ibora. Meanwhile, it would be years before Miguel Ricart would face a judge for the brutal accusations levied against him, which I will get into on the next episode of the Unresolved Podcast.
Thank you.